help somebody that comes in there to take over his job. So Steve, you'll go ahead, buddy. Love to hear about what's happened with the police department and the criminals a long time ago, and thank you.
Okay, and is this coming through at all?
No.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Put it on, I guess, put it on there.
Maybe it was there. It wasn't all the way up, it looked like it was on, but it was not moving. Actually, what I decided to do is, instead of trying to cover all of the time that I've been down here in Wallington, which I first started working down here in 1971, I went back and picked out just a few pieces from the early years, like from 71 and 72, just to give you an idea of some of the wonderful, fun things that happened down here in what was then not all the city of Wallington, but a great part of it was the city. First of all, I have a question for long-term residents, because this came out of something that I found in a notebook from 1971. I was trying to figure out where it was, and I think I know, but it's Wallington Rental Center.
That's in the blank barn now?
Well, I thought originally we were thinking that it was probably the one that eventually became Anderson's, and now is whatever it is. But then somebody else mentioned, and I remembered a small shop down on Seneca Street, about right in the middle of the lake right now, back in the early 70s, and it was next to the laundromat, if I remember correctly. Now, somebody said that it was only a small engine repair shop, but I thought it was also the rental center. Now, maybe somebody can help me out and tell me, am I off in right field, or was there something down there like that?
Curves and
that's Tonka down there.
Yeah, there's a rental place there, but
I thought that in like 1971 or so, that was still being used either as a barn or as storage, but I could be wrong on that.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, if somebody knows where the Walton Rental Center was, the reason I ask that is I'm looking through my notebooks and I come up with contact the caller at the White House across from the Tualatin Rental Center. And I'm going, okay, where is the Tualatin Rental Center?
Yeah. Rick Storm was used as a rental place for a while. Had a bit of a white house with a two.
Yeah, it would have been.
I was wondering, Steve, do you need to return something?
Yeah, I've had it since then. No, I couldn't remember where it was, but now that you mention it, it was used as a rental center back then. And that that may have been about the right time, too. But anyway, one of the, it just reminded me of something else that, there's a lot of funny stories that come out of downtown and Tualatin. And as a matter of fact, one of the best ones is what I'm going to start off with. And this was actually just outside of what is now the city of Tualatin on Highway 99W, just a little bit south of Seipel or Sepulley Road, depending upon how you want to pronounce it. And the farm that's there on the, it's either the south side or the east side of the highway, depending upon which way you think the highway goes through there. We got a call one night when I was, as a matter of fact, I wrote it down. How about May 31st of 1971, at about 2:45 in the morning, we got a call down there, a cries for help. And so we went down there, and I still had a training officer with me. And so we went down there, and we drove slowly along the highway with our windows down, and sure enough, we could hear off in the distance, help! Help! No.
No.
talks. No, I've had that tricked up before too. But so we finally got out of the car and wandered on down into the farm down there and fished this gentleman out of a kind of a small pond. No, cesspool would probably be the more appropriate term for it. He was quite intoxicated and had fallen into the pit where they clean out the pig pens. And you can only imagine the smell and why I wouldn't want to get any closer than for me to about the back of the roof. And of course, he was drunk. He wanted to come up closer and talk to you as a testament to that. But I got even, well, actually, I didn't do this. My coach kind of did this. Our sergeant came up to see what we had, and he drove up. He was driving the captain's brand new car. The captain was on vacation. And so we're trying to figure out what to do with this guy, and my coach, being a smart aleck, says, well, why don't you go talk to the sergeant? Maybe he can find a way to get you somewhere. So he, of course, wanders on over there, leans up against the captain's new car. It took the sergeant about 3 seconds before he was doing 70 miles an hour up the highway and towards Sidon, leaving the poor guy for us to deal with. Yes?
Mark Johnson.
Yes. And actually, the guy apparently was some acquaintance of the Johnsons there and had tried to awaken them at the house and was unsuccessful, and so he was wandering around the pig farm quite intoxicated, and he had a rather unpleasant demise. Eventually, we did wake somebody at the house, and they took care of him, but they did hose him off before they let him go to the house. Kind of an interesting call to give you an idea as to how much the area has changed. Just a few days after our pig farm incident, we got a call down onto Norwood Road to contact Burl Cunningham. It seems as though we had some trespassers in his field. Christensen's cows were in his field eating his grain. And so we had arranged a civil compromise, as we call it, which is where the people work out how to pay for damages. However, that was my first opportunity to deal down in what was then Lake Street, which was quite an interesting road. And the area where the cows were out is very close to where I live, and actually it's probably part of the high school property now. So that was kind of an interesting little twist on that. One of the things that I noticed in going back through my records from the early 70s is there has been a significant shift in the type of crime that occurs. In the early 70s, there were people breaking into houses and businesses every day. I mean, I think that there were times that I took 2 and 3 burglary reports per day in the early 70s. And that is actually where I met one of your members. No, he was not the one breaking into the houses. Stan Pryor, I was looking through a notebook, and there is this burglary down on Howard Drive. And the witness, or the neighbor that I contacted, who gave me some information on who may be involved in this, was a guy by the name of Stan Pryor. I'm looking at that and I'm wondering, is that the same Stan Pryor that now in the So I happened to run into Stan at a council meeting just recently, and yes, it was the same Stan 30 plus years ago. Wow. So.
Still look the same, don't it?
Yep, both of us do. We're both still young. Actually, I was a skinny kid then. To give you an idea, the burglaries that we had down here, there was a couple of them that I found one morning back in June of 71. The Texaco and the Shell station on Nyberg, that's the old Texaco and the old Shell station, were both burglarized overnight. My first acquaintance with City Hall was also in June of 1971. And I was kidding Doug Rucks about this because I found the window open in what is now his office. The City Hall at that time was in the council building. And the second floor of it was unfinished. So, yeah, that's kind of the way that things have progressed since over the last 30 years as the city has grown. Pardon me? Also in 71, if any of you were here around that time, you'll remember that where the Shiloh Inn is now was a large warehouse. It was actually Butler's Tires. It was a tire warehouse. And they had been the victim of a couple of different break-ins where they had been stealing tires out of there. And that was actually a common occurrence throughout the metro area at the time, as they were breaking into these warehouses stealing tires. So one night there was a security guard who happened to have that on their rounds. He pulls into Butler's Tires. The side door is open. You can hear people inside, so he gets on his radio telephone as a long cordless cell phone. Is that me? And he calls for the police. Well, before we can get down there, the two guys who are inside the business come out and start running down the side of the building. He, of course, is trying to figure out what to do, so as we all were wanting to do back in those days, he pulled out his gun and fired a warning shot. The only thing that did is cause the two people to run twice as fast. So by the time we got down here, of course, they were long gone. I suspect they were probably... when I got the call, I remember this well. I was up in the Progress Plaza by Washington Square. I came down here, and I suspect by the time I got down here, those two guys had run into Portland.
Well, Steve, you were still with the sheriff, weren't you, at that time?
There wasn't a Tualatin Police Department. Right. And as a matter of fact, at that time, the city of Tualatin was contracting for 10 hours a month for police services from the sheriff's office. And so, however, the area that I was working for the sheriff's office at that time was everything south of Canyon Road, everything east of Hillsboro. So that'll give you an idea as to some of the territory that we had to cover at one time or another. And what was even more fun is when there happened to be only two of us on duty, which I did work with, where there was only two of us on duty in the county outside the cities. And we kind of split it up where everything south of Canyon Road and Fallen Valley Highway through Forest Grove was one district, and everything north of that was another one. There were some interesting occurrences down on 108. And it was where I had some, well, I don't really know everything that happened down there because, you know, 108th used to be a gravel road between Herman and Fallen Road. Mm-hmm. And I do know that when I drove down there with three other officers one night, there was a fellow who was barricaded in a house with his 30-30. Now, he told us that he, in fact, fired three rounds into the roadway ahead of our cars as we were coming down the road. We were driving on the gravel road, we could have. We found empty shell casings inside the front door. This was not the first time that we've dealt with this gentleman, nor would it be the last time. He had done something similar to that. He'd gotten a disagreement with his family, who actually was his sister who he was living with there. He'd get into beefs with them and would pull out his 30-30 rifle and point it at him and chase them all out of the house. And all the cops would go down there then, and they'd talk to him and talk him out. Well, this time, one time before this, he had gotten into a disagreement, a fight with his sister, and I'd gone down there and I talked him out of his gun, and everything was fine and dandy. We got to be on a first name basis. And so instead of fighting with his sister, he called me. He called the sheriff's office and say, you know, send Steve down here, my God. We knew we were in trouble, however, this one night when all four of us went down there, because he called in, or actually his sister called in, and they put him on the phone. And the dispatcher knew that I had developed a relationship with this guy and could calm him down. He says, do you want me to send Steve down there? I don't want him to come down here. I don't want him to show up. And so we kind of thought that things, the rules of the game had changed significantly. And in fact, when we went down there, that's when he said that he fired the rounds in front of our cars. He never fired a shot before that any time. He always just pointed the gun at people. There was kind of a humorous incident in this thing, and it had happened in June of 1972. There's a couple of humorous pieces to this. First of all, I started as a police officer in March of 1971. In June of 1972, there were four officers who went to this residence with this guy barricaded in there with his rifle. I was the most senior of the four. Yeah, so that gets a little scary because technically I'm in charge. The second part that was humorous is that we got some more senior people down there. They started trying to talk to him and that kind of thing. And they said, we need somebody to go across the street and behind these trees, or across the street from the house, and set up and be your sniper. And in case this guy comes out with a gun, you know, you can shoot him. And I said, okay, fine. Well, you know where Levitton Drive now comes into 108? And if you go right straight, there's a little house right there. As a matter of fact, somebody went straight just recently and drove right into their front room. Well, that's the same little house that this guy was in. And if you remember correctly, years ago, what was across the street? There were a couple of houses and a cow pasture. I belly crawled through the cow pasture. It was right after dusk, so it was dark enough. And I couldn't see what I was doing, and fortunately the cows didn't step on me. Now, fortunately I could smell the cow eyes before I ran into them and kind of weave my way through there. I spent almost 4 hours in the tree across the street. But about 11:30 midnight, right in that area, the undersheriff, who was the number two in command at the sheriff's office, right below the sheriff, had come out and was actually negotiating with this guy, trying to get him to come out. And Dick had the front door open on this house, and there were lights on inside, and you could see Dick, and he'd be standing there in the doorway with his rifle, and, you know, alternately talking to the officers. And Chuck Sheriff was the undersheriff, and he worked his way up right along the shadow edge of the light as it came out the door. Chuck got probably, I don't know, 30, 40 feet away from the door. And he says to this guy, he said, Dick, are you a smoker? Yeah. Chuck says, well, so am I. He says, do you mind if I have a cigarette? Chuck says, or Dick says, no, go ahead. So Chuck takes a cigarette out, puts it in his mouth. Dick, and I think he was kind of being a smart aleck, he said to him, says, aren't you afraid that when you light that thing up, I'll know where you are and I'll shoot you? Chuck just stopped for a second, took the cigarette out of his mouth, put it back in his pack, and he says, you know what? He says, I just read this warning on the cigarette. He says, I should, smoking maybe hazardous. Of course, all the rest of us around, I thought that was pretty funny. We eventually talked him out of his house. We took him down to the state hospital because he was in need of some significant mental health care. That was not the last time I ran across him. We chased him one night across Interstate 5, right at Nyberg Road, going from what's now the Sweetbriar over to where Jiggles is now. in 5 o'clock traffic.
Ooh,
he ran out in front of the semi. I stopped. He did not get hit. The semi jackknifed there on the freeway. So, you know, that's just some really colorful history from down there in the city of Tualatin. First time I met Clayton Nyberg was in 1971 when I told him that his horses that were in the wetlands, or actually were not in the wetlands, they were on the upper side of Nyberg, were out in the street. You know, we'd either round them up and get them out of the street. Kenny and Sandy Harper, for those of you who don't know who they were, Kenny was with the Brothers Speed. Yes, nice people. You know, I would say some of these names, but I'm afraid that somebody either might know them. But one of the things that often happened back in the early 70s was that, and I worked a lot of nights, I have to go back a step and tell you that I spent 9 years in patrol, and six of that was working the night shift. And that was by choice. So at nighttime, the world is totally different. But one of the things that we used to see a lot of is what we call parkers. You know, the young people get in the car, they go out, they find themselves a nice dark place, and hopefully they're alone. And of course, then the nasty old cops come down and interrupt them and find out what they're doing down in these nice dark places. And the city park was a common place for that to happen. That, you know, that parking area north of the trestle was nice and dark. And, you know, I think that probably about once a night I chased somebody out of there. And, you know, I always wrote down their names prior to them. And that's where I say that, you know, I really probably shouldn't mention it. Some of them may actually either be acquaintances or actually maybe here. Well, you'd love to see some of the stuff that I have in these notebooks.
You don't have to say who they were with.
I didn't remember this until I was going back to the notebooks, but you remember the old police department building that was over here on Boone Spur, the old Lavin Electric building?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that the Lavin Electric building was there on September the 23rd, 1972, because I went to an alarm now. So I know that building was there for close to 20 years, or close to 30 years, excuse me. One of my introductions to Tualatin happened in the beginning of September of 72. And remember I said there's a lot of burglaries, and one of them was at a residence on Avery. A fellow by the name of Gary Hewell was the victim, 8015 Avery. And people had broken into his house, and among the other things that they'd stolen was a 44 Magnum revolver. And they thought that maybe these kids from the area and some visitors were involved in this burglary. And I didn't write down the name of the people whose house they were possibly at, which was down at the clear at the far end of Blake Street. And I mean, clear back in the trees. And so after I take this burglary report, of course, then I go to look for these kids that may be involved in this. So I'm driving down Blake. Now, those of you who have been around for a while, remember Blake was about a one-lane gravel road. There were trees down both sides of it. At night, it was awfully dark back there. And as I'm driving back there, there's this thought that crosses my mind. These kids have stolen a 44 Magnum bolt and ammunition. Gee, I hope they're not there. This is looking worse and worse as I get back there. I hope they're not there. Well, thank God they weren't there. Actually, they turns out they fled back to Minnesota, where two of them were from. They were all arrested back there, and we recovered the revolver about a month later. But there's this thought I still remember it to this day as I'm driving down there, you know, those big redwood trees are along the edge of this road going, I really hope they're not dead. let's see, what are some of the other crazy things that we did? A little later on, we had a cattle rustling down here in Tualatin, or actually it was just outside the city. Clark Davenport looked out on Hazelbrook and had a black Angus heifer stole it. It's just one of those fun things. Actually, it was July 7th of 1972 that I met Stan Bragger. I wrote that in there too. And I want to close with a kind of a humorous story, another one from back in the olden days. I happened to have worked Tualatin on October the 31st, 1972.
Oh boy.
Halloween. I got a call from some young people throwing eggs. Now, in 1972, Tualatin didn't look anything like it does today. You know, there were very few residential areas. Clarion Lane, there was a portion of Apache Bluff, and there was this brand new area, which I can't remember the name of what they called it, but it was down off of Avery and 86th and Seminole Trail, and they were down on Seminole Trail. Well, I happened to know where Seminole Trail was because my sister-in-law lived in that cul-de-sac, and I didn't know that at the time, but because I hadn't met my wife by then. Anyway, I drive down into this cul-de-sac on Seminole Trail, and here are these three young kids standing there, about 15. And so I get out of the car, and I say, you know, hey, I got to call that some kids were throwing eggs down here. You haven't seen anything, have you? And they, of course, said, no. Well, they've all got jackets on. So I said, well, I walked up to them, I said, well, you don't mind if I check your pockets, do you? When I left them, all three of them were pulling eggshells out of their pockets. I got in the back of my car and I told the dispatcher, I think that I solved the egg throwing problem. I don't think they threw any more eggs that night. So maybe onto the pavement. You know, I didn't ask, frankly, how long I had to talk on, and I figured I'd go for about a half an hour, and then if you have any questions or, you know, I can lead you astray in any other way, I'd be happy to do so.
Well, let me start. You be thinking of some questions. Are there any unsolved crimes in Tualatin?
Yes, there are a couple that are still unsolved. Probably the most famous is the unsolved homicide, the bodies, the bones from the two females that were found out here off of Tualatin Road. They thought they were connected to the Green River Killer. There is, the last that I knew, there is belief that they're not connected to them. And the fact is that they've gotten some information out of an informant from the state penitentiary that there may have been even more bodies in the area. But, you know, we have never found anything. That's probably the most famous unsolved case that we have down here.
What about the spot
there? You want to talk about the spot? See, Ray Ritchie Gardner, Stephen Zabriskie, Edward Pete London, I think, were the three guys that were involved. I can't remember the female's name. And the only reason that I know those three is that I actually was not working on the road at that time. I got sentenced to 30 days in the county jail. That's what we used to call it when, as a deputy, we were sent to the jail to work in the jail for a month.
Oh.
So I got sentenced to 30 days in the county jail, and I was working in the jail and booked those three people in the jail on the Great Spot Tavern homicide, which happened in January of 73, if memory serves me correctly. And this was, my understanding was a ongoing kind of a dispute between the people that were involved in that. I didn't get to know a whole lot about the background of it, other than the fact that's what happened, or that was what supposedly happened, and that, like I said, I got to book the three people in the jail, and they were the three guys, and I cannot remember the female's name, who was arrested at the same time. And they were all either members of the Brothers Speed or associates of them.
For those of us that weren't here then, what happened?
Actually, they were all convicted or pled guilty. Zabriskie actually was back out again. He'd been released about, what was after we started the police department down there, so it had to have been either the late 80s or early 90s. And he got into a beef up at a tavern in Tigard and got arrested for assault, and his parole was revoked and he got sent back, and I don't know if he's back out and about. I have not heard what happened to the other ones. But basically what happened is they got into a big fight down at the Spot Tavern, and one of them pulled out a knife, or one or two of them pulled out a knife, and stabbed one person in the back and killed him. They cut another one basically side to side across the back during the fight. And then they took off, but they were caught a short distance away.
Steve, was that the place that was on Nyberg on the south side of the street?
No, the spot is now the White Buffalo.
Oh, Buffalo.
The Buffalo, yeah. No, the Spot Tavern is actually the same place that the Country Inn is. That's now the Country Inn.
Oh!
They changed the name.
Yeah. The Spot, as a matter of fact, the city revoked the liquor license the day after the homicide, if I remember correctly. And OLCC then followed suit. There's a photo reader man. But he one day goes to a fight at the Spot Tavern. He parks his car under this ferry, jumps out, runs across the street, runs a few feet towards the door of the Spot Tavern, runs on beyond the door of the Spot Tavern to pick up his gun, which has fallen out of its holster, sliding down the sidewalk. He goes down, he picks up his gun, brushes it off, puts it back in his holster, and goes on into the fight. The people who were outside, who actually originally were part of the fight, I guess were laughing so hard that the fight was pretty much over by that point.
What about the killing of those
cops? Buzz Powell. That was... I don't know much about that. Weren't there three people who were involved in the spot, in the ownership of that at one time? And that was, wasn't that the fallout that ended up with Buzz being dead? That's what I don't know a whole lot about that. I don't think I was that privy to a lot of that information. I was just a little street cop at the time. The detectives didn't tell us a whole lot. I knew that stuff had happened, but frankly, I don't know much about it. I don't think so. That was... I'm trying to think, was that about 69? Yeah, it was before I started as an officer. I remember just, you know, the details of it, that somebody thought that it was a business deal gone bad and everybody went sideways and nobody was going to talk about who did what. And so they were never able to solve that. But that's about all that I know about it. They initially moved out to Southeast Portland I'm trying to remember where the clubhouse was. They now have a clubhouse in Hillsboro, and I thank Ron Louie, who's the chief out in Hillsboro, for keeping them out there.
Steve, just for
couple minutes talk about how things are now?
You said there had been a change over time. What are those changes?
Well, there's a couple of changes I think that really are significant. Number one is, you know, we're not seeing people breaking into houses and businesses that much anymore. Compared to, say, 15, 20 years ago when we first started the police department, our burglary rate is probably half of what it was then, the actual numbers. And, you know, you figure that the city's grown probably at least double in size in that time. And the burglaries have been cut in half. What they're doing now, which they did some of back then, but not a whole lot of, is that they do a lot of forgeries. They do, you know, computers help them a lot with their identification and that type of thing. And so you've seen this big shift in crimes from the breaking into houses and that type of thing into doing the crimes that are less risk, like forgeries and the identity thefts. Actually, what's kind of interesting is, as I was looking through one of the cases that I worked on, is down here in Walton, is the theft of a transmission. Now, you laugh about that, but frankly, back in the 60s, that was, or 60s and early 70s, that was big business. Stolen car parts. We chased this transmission around. I don't think we ever actually were able to get it back. But, you know, I mean, so-and-so had some information, but so-and-so had it. And you know, I mean, we went through that kind of a thing for probably 3 weeks.
Mail theft is something that kind of disturbs me. We used to, it ain't country anymore where you can't have a regular mail car.
Oh, yeah, it's... And you know, there actually was mail theft that was occurring back in the early 70s, but what they were after then was not the same things they're after now. You know, they're after your checks, they're after anything with your identification on it. No, back then, believe it or not, they were stealing mails by cash. A lot of people still throw it at the or send cash through mail, and they steal mail for that. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting, and this is a total change in the way that we deal with crime. It's not necessarily a total change in crime, but it was the way we dealt with domestic disturbances. I mean, I'm reading in my notebook of, you know, the best one that I saw was one where she got into the family car, saw it was low on gas, went and put Chevron gasoline in it, brought it home after she did her errands or whatever, told him that she was upset that he left it with an empty tank of gas. He got mad because she put Chevron gasoline in it. Honest to God, this is both of their stories. But the interesting thing is that, you know, in my notes, in the notebook, it says, you know, he slapped her, knocked her down, pushed her against the wall, you know, she showed injuries and all this kind of stuff. And how did we resolve that? We got him to leave. That was standard practice back then. We just got him to leave, broke up the fight, and hope things would work out. Never arrested him. I mean, people today in that situation would be going to jail.
Yeah. This is more up to date. It seems like I heard it once on the radio last week that someone was robbed. Was walking at the corner of 90th and Street Drive. Is that right?
Well, there was a robbery down there. The victim was not a female. It's one of these things, you know, frankly, we view these things and you go, wait a minute, you know, there's something that people aren't telling us. But, you know, there was a legitimate robbery. We did end up taking somebody into custody. But why is it that the suspect or the victims know that the suspect is a friend of somebody that they know?
Well, the reason I ask is I live in a county corner for the police station. Yeah. And I walked that way a lot of times.
Yeah,
and
then
no, I walked that trail behind. Now, is that safe to walk through there?
We haven't had any problems in there at all.
Except people throwing stuff down.
Yeah, well, people throw stuff into wetlands. Actually, I guess that our operations crews have figured out ways to fish that stuff out of there fairly efficiently.
Well, it has been cleaned a long time, and now the last time I looked, there was all these cans and carts.
I don't know what. Can we plant little electrodes in some of them? Sorry.
I had asked you one time about something to do with law enforcement data system, and I was surprised that you said, because that was one of the things being cut back by the legislature, and I was surprised when you said how important it was to the police. And I was wondering in general, what impact you see, the courts, the closure of the courts on Fridays and all that stuff. That seems a little bit remote, but how do these cutbacks affect city police aside from the court?
You know, we're seeing the increase in reported crime this year is staggering. I mean, it's like 30% increase over last year.
Why?
We have seen a significant increase in thefts from vehicles, like a 70% increase in thefts from vehicles. That's a low-risk crime. And so that's what people are doing now. Instead of breaking into houses, they're doing the low-risk crimes, the thefts from vehicles, the forgeries, that kind of thing. Our forgeries, I think if I remember correctly, our identity thefts have about doubled between last year and this year. But that means that we've gone from like 10 to 20. They're not a great big number. Interesting thing that has almost doubled also this year is domestic assaults. Go ahead and figure out why. I think it's probably the economy, the stress that's being created as a result of that, and people don't have any way to deal with that stress. The other thing that frankly has gone out of sight is the number of drug arrests. We don't have a detective that's assigned to drugs. Our patrol people deal with it when they come across it. They've more than doubled, they've almost tripled, I think, between last year and this year. Tremendous amounts of methamphetamine in the area. We arrested a guy over here in Tualatin 3 months ago, and we had worked our way up buying stuff from him, and we had arranged to buy an ounce of methamphetamine from him. Now, that's a significant amount of methamphetamine. When you buy an eighth to a quarter of a gram for $25 to $50, so it's several thousand dollars worth of methamphetamine. That's the kind of stuff that's available. We one of our alert officers here about 6 months ago was over at Motel 6 and saw a car with British Columbia plates pulling away from another car that somebody was just getting into, and thought, you know, gee, this is kind of odd. What's the guy with the British Columbia plates doing pulling out of here at 2:30 in the morning? And so he went over and checked out the one guy then that was left. And he got 3 pounds of marijuana out of his car. The guy had just bought it.
Just 3 pounds. What does this have to do with the state, though? It doesn't sound like it. Either I'm not quite sure if you mean it because there's less penalty, there's a more increase, or is this something else?
Well, no, what's actually happening is a whole series of events. There's not just what's happening in the state, but for example, in Multnomah County, or in all the counties, they didn't prosecute any misdemeanors for 3 months. They didn't prosecute a lot of the lower level felonies for 3 months. Most people were, in fact, if they were arrested, were turned loose the next day. And so we had a lot of those people back on the street. You know, Multnomah County had those, or had that guy that stole 20 some odd cars or something like that in 3 months. You know, that's the kind of things that were happening because they weren't being processed through the courts. The other thing is, frankly, as the stress on the financial picture of the state got worse, they were looking at what they could do to reduce costs within the corrections division. guns in prisons. And so they were getting more and more stringent as far as who they would take and not take. And that then resulted in a lot more of these people ended up on probation, which puts them back in the community. And they were also then crunching the probation system. So the probationers were ending up with larger caseloads. They weren't tracking the people as they should. And it resulted in more people out there, more motivated offenders, as the theory says, to commit crime.
I have a question. With the gang-related type things, a few years ago, you heard more about them. Is it getting better in Tualatin, or worse, or about the same?
There was a concerted effort on the part of the entire community back in the mid-90s to address the gang problem. And our gang problem in Tualatin virtually disappeared. It was down at zero I don't even think we're having gang graffiti show up anywhere in the community probably for 2 years. We've had a few filter back in, and there are actually hardcore gangsters who are moving into the area from outside the area. We arrested one at the high school last year for a fight, and he's a gang member out of LA who had moved up here. It's a typical process that happens, unfortunately, too often, is that, a kid will be get involved in gang activity. The family will say, geez, we need to get him out of this environment so that, this doesn't continue on. They'll move him up here to live with Aunt Tilly or whoever. And the unfortunate thing is if they're far enough into it, they're just going to start that same level of activity here. And we end up dealing with it.
I see a couple of police on motorcycles recently. Are those Tualatin? Do they want to call it the state or?
No, that is state police. They have two motors and one of their sergeants that occasionally works out of our office also riding the motor.
I know when the officers over here, I see them. There's a lot of number of state police cars. Would they just use it for convenient place to store them, or what is the relationship?
No, actually the state police lease office fixed for us. And at their peak, they had 13 troopers or sergeants that were working out of our office. I think they're at 9 right now. They've actually sent more up into this area because of the horrendous traffic problems that we're having out here, primarily on the freeways. Their responsibility is I-5 from the Portland city limits down to Aurora, and then I-205 over to roughly Oregon City. And that's the troopers that work out of our office, that's where they're supposed to be. And they do keep busy.
You mentioned Aurora, that comes in some of the background. Why are they police report or accident report so many miles on the freeway in Aurora? Wilsonville is closer to the freeway than Aurora, I think. Aurora's way 4 or 5 miles away.
I know. Remember back years ago, Aurora was significantly larger than Wilsonville.
Yeah.
And so everyone gave reference to Aurora, and I don't know why. It's like, frankly, for years, Sherwood was bigger than Aurora.
Yeah.
What year was it that the police department was established? And then it seems silly, but I've forgotten by now, when was it 3 years ago, the new building?
Yeah, the Tualatin established their own police department January 1st, 1987. Mm-hmm. And we moved into the new building in July of 2000. I can't remember the exact date, but it was early July of 2000. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which incidentally is still, we still have people come through there and go,
wow,
what a nice facility.
It's a higher ground.
Well, yeah, and we have the Sherwood people say, yeah, the yours is still nicer.
Let me ask a question then, how big is the force now?
We have a total of 33 sworn officers on the police department now.
And so most of us remember when it was Washington County Sheriff, like you said, 10 hours a month or a week, you said, month. What about the body, or at least the person that was stuffed into the Baskin Robbins freezer? I remember that one.
Yeah, we solved that one. Actually, Kathy Rivas, who was the shooter in that incident, made the Wall Street Journal. Yes, the Wall Street Journal did a story on the prison industries in Oregon about early 90s sometime. And one of the people that they took a picture of and got comments from was Pepe Rivas. And he was the shooter over here in our Baskin Robbins homicide. So, that's just a little sideline for you. He's infamous, I guess. Yeah.
My daughter was in high school at the time, working for Baskin Robbins in Washington Square, and it was short of help at this one because of the murder. And so she ended up working there.
Actually, it was probably the safest place to be because of all of the cops that ran out of there and everything else. There's kind of, it's a little bit of a morbid sense of humor that we found after a little while, but there isn't a small bit of humor to that incident. And it involves one of our sergeants, who is now a sergeant by the name of Brad King. Brad had gone to court at that point and came back, and I think it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I needed to get out of the office, and so I said, Brad, let's go get a cup of coffee. And so he said, okay. So we went to Winchester, the last time I ever went to Winchester. Went to Winchester, had a cup of coffee. We were walking out to the car to leave, and they gave a call of an employee theft, is where that call came out, at Baskin Robbins. And so Brad goes over to Baskin Robbins, and I go get my binder so that we can write things down. And as I walk in the door, Brad's talking to the owner that's there, and the owner's saying, well, the safe is empty, the employee's gone. And Brad says, well, have you looked around? And they said, no, not really. So we started looking around the place. Brad goes into the freezer and, of course, finds the victim's body. Brad has never gone to coffee with me. August of 1987, he absolutely refuses to go to coffee with me.
Another question right here.
Steve, can you tell us just a little bit about what you're doing now? Anything you share with us?
Well, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing now. I've got about four or five different irons in the fire. One of the things that it looks likely that I'm going to do, for those of you who didn't know, I actually finished my doctorate in June. I successfully defended my dissertation. I graduated in August. And so I'm going to be teaching at least part-time at Portland State in their executive leadership program. And I may be doing some other things depending upon what other people come up with. I've got two or three different people who say, geez, why don't you get a hold of me when you really retire and let's talk about this. So, I don't know, I'm going to have to keep busy. And for those of you who know my wife, Doris, she's still going to be in town. She, although she moved from up on the hill, she's over here on Bridgeport across from where Bridgeport Village is going to be. And she just signed another 3-year office lease there, so we'll be around for a while. You can't get rid of me quite that easily.
I think the Portland Police Bureau could use your help.
They're beyond my help.
Way beyond. There's a few people in here, Steve, that probably glad that you weren't sheriff or police chief then. Some right in the front row, probably those Parkers, I don't know. He grew up down on the river, they raised their family. Who others would have stories to tell that you now can freely admit? 7 years.
Statute of limitations.
And we have Karen Larson, grew up in this area. Just a lot of people here who probably are glad that statue ran out. But we really appreciate your time today and your service to this community. We want to give you a pack of our famous note cards from our society that have either the Sweet House or some old farm scenes in our area. And was there any last question anybody had? We did have Steve's mom with us at a meeting this spring, I think it was. And then when Steve appeared at our board meeting, when we met at the police station in that nice room, Steve did a little presentation there, and the board got really excited about what they heard and wanted to make it a full program. So we appreciate what you're doing. And if there's no further questions, we will adjourn this part of the meeting and reconvene in 10 minutes. So there's coffee.